Bon, bonsoir à tous, je vous propose de commencer. Donc l'exposé sera en anglais, donc je vais passer à l'anglais pour la suite. So good afternoon everyone, and welcome to this distinguished seminar. So my name is Xavier Leroy, I'm a professor here at Collège de France, and it's a rare pleasure, an immense honor, to welcome Dr. Robert Targeon, distinguished professor at Princeton University and chief scientist at Intertrust Technologies. So I don't think he needs much of an introduction in this audience, but Robert Targeon is famous for his work on algorithms and data structures. He received the ACM Turing Award in 1986 for his early work, and many other major awards. But actually, his celebrity goes beyond the Turing Award. I think his name is familiar to every computer science graduate. And in the last 30 years, every CS student studied or implemented an algorithm that bears the name of Targeon and was amazed by the elegance and efficiency of those algorithms. So that's really fame with a capital F. So currently, Robert Targeon is visiting IRIF, the Institute de Recherche en Informatique Fondamentale, of CNRS and University Paris Diderot, and tonight's seminar is organized jointly with IRIF. And so Claire Mathieu, now at IRIF and former professor at Collège de France, will say a few more words.
Thank you, Xavier. It's a great pleasure to have Bob Targeon here this evening. Earlier today, I asked him, what are your favorite papers? And he gave me a few examples, so I printed the first page of several of these examples. One of them. So his first answer was, I like depth-first search. Now, computer science is here. Come on. This is so elementary. And linear time algorithms. Okay. He told me he also likes union find. Now, this is trickier, because you're not talking about linear time there. You're talking about the inverse Ackermann function. So suddenly, you're changing territory. Almost linear, but not quite. And then he said he also likes his randomized linear time algorithm for minimum spanning trees. Linear time again. Now, if you look at all these various results that he mentioned, they have one thing in common, which is that the algorithm is very simple. And then the proofs are elegant, they can be very clever, but they have in common this beauty, the elegance of simplicity. So I hope that this evening, as we hear and learn about concurrent connected components, once again, we'll get to see something elegant. Thank you.
Thank you, Claire. Thank you. Well, it's a real treat to be here, and I want to talk about some recent work that I've been doing with one of my grad students at Princeton, Sikyue Liu. But let me start with some basic observations. I've been in this field since it started, more or less, and computer science is still young. So over the last 60 years or so, we've developed many beautiful and theoretically efficient algorithms, but they don't necessarily get used so much in practice for various reasons. For one thing, theoreticians often have tried to develop efficient algorithms at the expense of simplicity. And programmers, practitioners, need to get something up and running fast, so sometimes they can simplify or oversimplify or invent their own possibly simpler methods that don't necessarily perform as they might expect. Yes, so there is this tension between theory and practice. How do we resolve this? Well, there are examples, and I'm going to show you some examples where the practitioners took some ideas from theory, modified them in what appeared to be reasonable ways, and produced algorithms that are either incorrect or don't have the efficiency that the people implementing them were hoping for. How can we help the situation? How can we as theoreticians help? Well, it's important to build simple methods. Build and analyze simple methods. The analysis can be complicated. This goes back to what Claire was saying, something I believed for my entire life, but even more now. Try to design the simplest possible methods. The analysis can be complicated. The reason the algorithm works or is efficient can be deep. The practitioner doesn't have to know about that, but they do have to be able to program the algorithm. They have to be able to implement it. And practitioners, I think it's very valuable to develop a relationship with a theoretician. Present your problems early while you still have a chance to get feedback. And if you can develop a long-term relationship with somebody who understands some of the theory, this can pay off not only immediately, but in problems you encounter going forward over time. And developing two-way feedback, getting common language, and so on is extremely important. So what I try to do, and another thing I should say, given that computer science is a young field, what we theoreticians have done is pluck the low-hanging fruit, of course, but the design space is huge. And as computers get faster and computer memories get bigger, the design space only becomes broader and richer. And plucking the low-hanging fruit, you may miss the beautiful fruit that's a little higher up. I think it's very important to systematically explore the design space, even on simple problems. Try to find the best algorithms, reference algorithms. Paul Erdős, who was a famous mathematician, had many intriguing notions, but one of them was proofs from the book. This is the book in the sky with the perfect proof, the supremely elegant, deep proof. So it's audacious to do that, but one can at least aspire to this idea. Come up with those ideas that are not improvable, best possible. Design algorithms that are as simple as possible with provable resource bounds for important input classes and efficient in practice. And to this goal, systematically explore the design space. Try all the possibilities, identify the ones that are best, and prove them. This quote is attributed to Einstein. Make everything as simple as possible, but not simpler. Oversimplification can get one into serious trouble. Now, to illustrate some of these points, I'm going to talk about one of the most basic graph problems, the connected components problem. So here, I'll have some slides of graphs in a minute, but what I mean by a graph is a collection of vertices joined by edges. Two vertices are in the same component if there's a path between them. This notion of being connected by a path is an equivalence relation, so it partitions the vertices into what are called the connected components, and this is what we want to find. We want to identify the connected components in a given graph, and that's the problem. So here is a graph. It has vertices numbered from 0 up to 8. How many connected components? 4 is connected to 5 by this path. 6 is connected to 5. One component. Two components. Three components. Okay. So you too can find connected components. How about, here's another one. How many connected components? Three. One, two, three. How about this graph? I think there are also three in here, but it's not so easy to see anyway. Humans do these calculations differently than computers do, obviously. So if we're going to solve this problem, we need a way to represent the components, and here is a very simple way. Let's assume the vertices are numbers 1 through n, and I'll use m to denote the number of edges. To identify the components, we'll label all the vertices in each component with a unique vertex in the component. And we can test whether two vertices are in the same component by comparing their labels. Equality corresponds to being in the same component. Inequality, not in the same component. A particular satisfactory labeling is the minimum labeling, which if the vertices are numbers, we label every vertex in the component with the minimum vertex in the component. This is just one possibility, but it's canonical, and we can design algorithms to compute the minimum labeling if we want to. So in this simple graph with seven vertices, it's only one component, everything is hooked together, and one is the minimum, so this is the labeling. Everybody gets number one. But we could equally well use any other vertex, just as long as any two vertices in the same component have the same label, and two vertices in different components have different labels. Now, there are two classic sequential algorithms, that is, one step at a time algorithms to solve the problem. The first is to use graph search, depth-first search, which Claire mentioned, or actually any kind of search will do here, breadth-first search, depth-first search, take your choice. Start at a vertex, follow edges to other vertices, keep going until you can't go any farther. That identifies all the vertices in one component. Start with another vertex, do a search from that vertex, that gives you another component. Keep going until you've used up all the vertices. There is another nice sequential algorithm that turns the problem into a data structure problem. We use a disjoint set or union find data structure. This is a data structure in which we want to maintain a collection of sets, disjoint sets, initially consisting of singleton sets with two operations. We'll also assume that every set has a uniquely determined canonical element. The two operations are a query operation called find, which returns the canonical element of the set containing element x, and unite, which is the update operation, which, given any two elements, if they are in different sets, puts the two sets together into a single set, destroying the two old sets in the process. If the two elements are already in the same set, this operation does nothing. And the algorithm gets to choose a new canonical element for the new set from among the elements in the combined set. So it's straightforward to use disjoint set union to solve the connected components problem. We just, for each edge in the graph, we unite the sets containing the endpoints. We initialize every vertex to be in a singleton set, and it's self-labeled. Then we do a unite for every edge in the graph. And then if we do a find on each vertex, we can then define the label to be the result of the find, because this does all the updates, and after we've done all the updates, the vertex sets correspond exactly to the vertex sets of the connected components, and there's some canonical element for each one that was picked by the algorithm, and we can determine that by doing a find and then just using that as the label of the vertex. We don't, in fact, have to execute this second loop because we can use the find operation to test for equality, to test whether two elements, two vertices are in the same set and the same connected component or not. Now, depth-first search or breadth-first search or any other kind of search, as long as it's simple enough, will run in linear time and edges plus vertices. The disjoint set union problem, there is a very nice data structure called the compressed tree data structure. And if you use two heuristics, path compression and linking by rank, you get a bound which is almost linear. And here is this inverse Ackermann function. The cost per operation turns out to be something which grows incredibly slowly as the inverse of Ackermann's function. So for those of you who don't remember or know Ackermann's function, It was constructed by Ackerman back in the 30s as something which is not primitive recursive. It grows faster than any primitive recursive function. That is, faster than any function defined by only a single variable recurrence. And the inverse function grows incredibly slowly. For all practical purposes, this is a constant. And here we see this other paper that Claire mentioned. So theoretically, this solution is slightly worse than this solution by this tiny overhead. But in fact, this solution has many appealing properties. First of all, you don't need to construct a representation of the graph. All you need is the edge set. You just iterate over the edge set, and you're basically done. Furthermore, you don't need the entire graph ahead of time. You can do individual and batch edge insertions. So this solution is more general in that you can update the graph on the fly as long as the updates are only insertions and not deletions of edges. Making the solution fully dynamic, allowing edge deletions, is another interesting problem that goes beyond what I want to talk about here. So, two nice solutions. These are very simple algorithms, even though the analysis of this one is quite complicated. Are we done? Well, given the advent of the internet and the World Wide Web and friendship graphs and things like that, all of a sudden people want to compute, in practice, connected components of really big graphs. I got a few examples that are not that big, but maybe illustrate the point. This one has to do with, so PLM stands for Product Life Cycle Management. So this is a network that corresponds to certain products, and the edges correspond to stages in the life cycle of the products, and things get quite complicated, and this is only a piece of it. This is some kind of protein interaction network. I'm not sure what this one is, but it's a mess. Here's some piece of a social network, like the Facebook friendship network, if you will. And people seem to actually want to compute connected components on these things, and big is really big. 10 to the 9th vertices, 10 to the 12th edges or more. For these sizes, sequential algorithms are maybe not fast enough, and given that the world has gone to highly parallel machines and platforms, Hadoop, MapReduce, cloud computing, and so on and so forth, there has gotten to be a lot of interest in solving even simple problems, but for very big problem sizes. So that's the question. Can we use parallelism to speed up the computation? Can we get sublinear time by throwing lots of processors at the problem? From a theoretical point of view, there are a couple of different computation models that the distinguishing factor is mainly whether you're dealing with a huge common memory, the parallel random access machine model, or a distributed memory where memory is chopped up into pieces and messages are getting passed back and forth. In any case, there are lots of processors trying to solve the problem in parallel. Most of the work on concurrent algorithms in the early days was in some version of the parallel random access machine model. This model is more realistic if one is interested in Hadoop, MapReduce, cloud computing, and so on. The very simple algorithms I will talk about can be implemented in either model, and I'll start out with the PRAM version of things. So here's a very simple concurrent algorithm called label propagation. We initialize the label of each vertex, which I'm now going to denote by V dot P for parent, for a reason I'll talk about in a minute. And then this is a parallel loop which runs over the arcs. I'm going to replace, for simplicity in expressing the algorithms, I replaced every edge. The edges are undirected pairs here. I'm going to replace each edge by an arc from V to W and an arc from W to V, so two oppositely directed arcs. This is not essential is just to make this representation easy. So this for every edge VW, this is doing something for the VW direction and the WV direction, so I didn't have to write this line twice, basically. We compare the labels of the two ends, and we assign the smaller one as a candidate for the new label of the bigger one. If this one is smaller, we're going to use it as the new label here. But all of these steps run synchronously in parallel. So all of these writes happen at the same time, all of these updates. And the rule is that the smallest value wins. So if there are several edges saying, update the label of the other end with a given value, whatever the smallest possible value is the one that wins. This is called, this is a very strong version of a PRAM, this way of resolving write conflicts. I'll come back to this point later. In any case, this algorithm is kind of a parallel version of breadth first search, and I'll quickly go through how it works on this example, which is numbered so that, now this algorithm is computing the minimum labeling because of this way of resolving the writes. There's a 2 over here and a 1 over here, and these vertices are going to end up with label 1, and some of these vertices are going to end up with label 2, but eventually all of these have to end up labeled 1 because 1 is the answer. So there's a slow process because there's a long path here before this vertex ends up labeled number 1. And here are the successive labels. And that's some number of iterations, but it's roughly the diameter. This algorithm runs in time, number of parallel rounds proportional to the diameter, and if the diameter is large or even not so small, this algorithm is very expensive because you're doing something on every single edge in parallel. And this algorithm was actually used, although the sequential algorithms run much faster than this simple label propagation algorithm. If we're going to use lots of processors, we don't want to spend time linear in the diameter. We want something much closer to constant or logarithmic or something like that. That's the goal here. So to this point, why are we thinking of the labels as parents? Because every vertex has a label. That means there's an implied arc from a vertex to its parent, to its label. This defines a directed graph, which is univalent. That is, every vertex only has a single outbound edge. If there are no cycles, except for self-loops, that is, a vertex is labeled with itself, then this directed graph consists of a set of rooted trees. A vertex is a root if and only if it's its own parent. And if it's not its own parent, then its parent is its parent. And if we're doing this minimum labeling process, we can guarantee this fact that there are no cycles except for self-loops. So we're manipulating a collection of trees, which is useful. Now, in fact, what we're trying to do is get a flat tree for each connected component, a flat tree being one in which the parent of every vertex is the root. So the process is we're changing labels somehow. Every set of labels defines a collection of trees. If we have a good algorithm, each of the trees is going to be a subset of the vertices in a connected component, and eventually the trees get connected together and squashed down until we get one flat tree per component. And the trouble with this algorithm is there's no squashing going on. So we have to iterate over potentially long paths before the information gets propagated. What about directly squashing the trees? So order of diameter is the bound for the label propagation algorithm. Not good. It doesn't work so well in practice. How do we do better? Here's the first idea, which is shortcutting. This is also known as pointer jumping. This was invented in, well, it was stated in around the late 70s, early 80s for this problem and related problem. Basically, we replace every node's parent, every vertex's parent by its grandparent. Here's the assignment. For every vertex in parallel, replace the parent by the grandparent. So if a vertex has a grandparent, its parent is getting closer to the root. One parallel iteration of this loop roughly halves the depths of all the vertices. It squashes all the trees by a factor of two. So there's some hope that it might give a logarithmic number of rounds. If we combine this with some kind of label propagation process. So if we put the two ideas together in the most obvious way, we get this algorithm, which I'll call algorithm C for connect. All the algorithms I'll present fit on 2/3 of a slide. So we got simple algorithms here. I'll talk about the history in a minute, but let's get some algorithms. So this one does, this is a parallel loop. This is the outer loop. You keep repeating until no parent changes, at which point all the trees are flat and there's one tree per component. This is the label propagation step, which I think is identical to the one in the naive algorithm, and this is the shortcutting step. So we do label propagation, then we do shortcutting repeat. Turns out this is no good because there are examples on which the trees stay flat throughout the process and it degenerates to essentially ordinary label propagation, so this is not enough. But it's not so obvious until you start thinking about counterexamples. So we need another idea or some modification here. So here's another idea, which is to modify the graph as we go along. Basically, we've got a collection of trees, and the roots are the active parts of the trees. We're really trying to connect together the roots, and then we can use the shortcutting process to flatten everything out. So this edge alteration is going to push the edges down toward the roots. To be specific, we replace each edge. If we look at the parents of the two ends. If they're the same, we just delete the edge. It's no longer relevant. If the ends are different, we replace the edge by an edge between the two parents. That's the step. And we'll translate this into the arc-based framework when we get to the next algorithm. So we're going to do this arc-wise rather than edge-wise. So here's the resulting algorithm. It's almost the same as algorithm C with the arc alteration step here, except we actually simplified the way the connection step works here. But there are three steps, and we do them repeatedly. And when we do each one, this is in parallel over all the edges, over all the arcs, in parallel over all the vertices, and in parallel over all the arcs. This transforms the arcs. And then we keep going. And if we look at this example again, this example is kind of too small to illustrate the effect, but I'll sketch it pretty briefly here. So the connect step makes some progress, and I should have drawn in the arcs corresponding to these labels. But so 5 gets 3, which is the minimum adjacent. 7 gets 5, which is the minimum adjacent. 4 gets 1, 6 gets 4, 3 gets 2. I think that's it. It's direct exchange of information, and the smallest value wins. Now we do the edge replacement process, which gets rid of a bunch of edges. Oh, sorry, we do the shortcutting next. So here's the result of the shortcutting. So if we back up a bit, we see that the parent of 7 is 5, the parent of 5 is 3. So the new parent of 7 after the shortcutting is going to be 3. And parent of 6 is 4, parent of 4 is 1. The new parent of 6 will be 1. So this is the result after the shortcutting. And now only 1, 2, and 3 are parents. The rest of the vertices, 4, 5, 6, 7, are not relevant to the computation anymore, in fact. And to capture that fact, we now modify the edges. We do the edge alteration step, which erases certain of the edges because the two parents end up being the same, and we're left with only two edges, the 3-1 edge and the 3-2 edge, unless I made a mistake. Then we do the next connection step, which makes 2 the parent of 1. So we now get instead of this information having to propagate all the way around, it can now propagate directly. And then the next edge alteration, this is the only edge left, which turns out not to be relevant anymore because we already labeled 2 with 1, but things continue for a while and then we get done. All right. Now so this is an interesting algorithm, and I'll talk about bounds on it later on, but it does have one, possibly a couple of drawbacks. First of all, there's this edge alteration process, which is standard, but maybe we don't need it. But more important is the way we're doing the connect steps, we can change the label of a vertex so that some vertex somewhere in a tree moves over to another tree. There's a certain monotonicity, non-monotonicity happening. We can split a tree by moving subtrees around. It's much easier to analyze what I'll call monotonic algorithms, which are algorithms that in the connect step only change the parents of roots. So they only put trees together, they don't move pieces of trees around. So we don't know that this is necessarily a drawback to have non-monotonicity, but let's think about how we can restrict the connect step to only update parents of roots, so we're only putting trees together, and still get something that might be good. Well, now it turns out we can get rid of the edge alteration as a byproduct, and we get, here's an algorithm which I'll call root connect, which only connects roots in the connect step. So it alternates, it repeats the outer loop until no parent changes. Inside it does a connection step and a shortcut. In this connection step now, it's looking at the labels, the parents of the two ends, and it wants to use the smaller one as a candidate for the label of the other one, but actually the parent of the parent. And only if this is a root. So if the parent of W is a root, it's self-labeled at this point, and V is smaller, then V becomes a candidate to be the parent of the parent. That's what this should be an arrow here. And again, there may be many candidates, but the smallest one wins. That's the tie-breaking rule here. And I haven't got an illustration of how this algorithm runs, but it restricts the connection step so that we never take trees apart. Now, there's an obvious generalization of this, which is instead of doing one shortcut for every iteration of the loop, we do several shortcuts. And why would we want to do that? If we don't, in fact, have as many processes or processors as there are edges, this is a parallel iteration over edges. This is a parallel iteration over vertices. We might have 100 times as many of these as we have these, so maybe we can afford 10 iterations of this loop for every iteration of this loop. Why not repeat this? So you could repeat this a constant number of times, like 2 or 10 or something. But the extreme version replaces the single shortcut by an inner loop that repeats the shortcutting until all the current trees are flat. So there's a tension between the connection step, which is connecting trees and building long paths, and the shortcutting process, which is squashing the paths. And this makes the analysis interesting. But the extreme version, we do this until we can't do it anymore. And that gives us this algorithm, which I'll call algorithm S for repeated shortcut. This just does the shortcutting until all the trees are flat, and then it does another connect step. And that's the repeat. So 3 algorithms plus one that's not so good. very simple algorithms, but these algorithms, exactly as I presented them, seem to be new. They use existing ideas, but they're simpler, more or less, than the existing algorithms. Why is this? And what can we say about how these algorithms perform? How many parallel rounds do we need? So we're going to need a number of processors proportional to the number of edges. That's the underlying assumption. If we have fewer, we're going to slow things down, but let's take the ideal case in which we have plenty of processors. Before answering this question, let's look at the history of the problem. So I'll break this into two pieces. The early era, which was the era of the theoreticians starting in the late 70s, mostly taking place from the 80s to the 2000s, in the parallel random access machine model, and the goal was to get smallest possible parallel time bounds and smallest possible total work. So total work is the number of processors times the parallel time here. These algorithms that I've described are all using linear number of processors, so keep that in mind. And as I mentioned early on, there was a lot of work to get good bounds, but the algorithms, some of them got quite complicated, which is not a drawback if you're interested in the theory, but it became a drawback when people actually wanted to implement some of these algorithms. So the model is we have a whole bunch of processes. Each one has a small private memory, and then there's a large shared memory, which in our case is going to contain the labels of the vertices. That's all we need, assuming we have a process per edge, which knows about the ends of the edges. All the processes run synchronously in lockstep. I'll talk about asynchronous processing at the very end. So the issue is, what happens with reads and writes to common memory? How do you resolve multiple reads and multiple writes to common memory? There are several variants that handle these conflicts in different ways. The EREW is exclusive read, exclusive write. In this model, no two processors are allowed to access the same common memory location at the same time, either for reading or for writing. That's the weakest model. If you can get good bounds in this model, they apply to the rest of the models as well. Perhaps unrealistically strong, that is, in the new distributed world, concurrent reads and concurrent writes, you can in fact implement. See, the next two models allow concurrent reading. Here we restrict the writing so that it's exclusive. That is, no two processes can try to write to the same location at the same time. The most powerful model here in terms of getting efficient algorithms, you can do concurrent reads and concurrent writes. Concurrent reads, everybody is reading the same value because they're reading at the same time. Concurrent writes, we need a way to resolve the write conflicts if two different processes are writing two different things to the same place. So this model subdivides depending upon how we resolve the write conflicts. The common model requires that all concurrent writes have to write the same value, otherwise the algorithm crashes. The arbitrary model, which is the one that was most used by the theoreticians, you allow concurrent writes, but you have no prediction over which one succeeds. That is, the system decides who wins, and your algorithm has to be correct no matter which write succeeds. Then there are various tie-breaking rules. Priority gives priority to the processes are numbered, and the highest priority process gets to do the write. The model that I'm working with is the combining model, where values concurrently written are combined using some symmetric function. So we're using the minimum function here. The minimum value wins. This is combining with the minimum function. Another version of this is the sum, where if multiple values are written, the sum is computed and installed in the location. This is maybe less realistic. This one is somewhat borderline in the PRAM world, but it's certainly implementable in the distributed model, and people use even stronger models than this in the distributed world. So these were the models used in the early days, but not this one. And let me just mention a few interesting results here. There's a beautiful algorithm by Shloach and Vishkin published in 1982. Runs in the arbitrary CRCW PRAM model, logarithmically many steps and linear processes. So the total work is linear times log n. It maintains trees. It does root connection, so it's monotone. It's very reminiscent of algorithm R, except it's more complicated. It does not do minimum labeling. It does two shortcuts rather than one per round, although they say that they only do this because it makes the analysis easier. And there's some extra computation to guarantee that every time you create a flat tree, it gets combined with some other tree every round. So basically, the number of trees goes down by a factor of two every round, and that's what allows them to prove the logarithmic bound here. So this is an example of designing an algorithm to get to a bound, an algorithm that is maybe more complicated than it needs to be. They have a nice, even with the complication to get the bound, it's still not entirely straightforward to get the bound. And they give an interesting example, which shows that if they simplify their algorithm, the logarithmic bound goes away. It's essentially, this is some constant times d. This is the diameter, remember. So in a situation where you have a diameter linear in the number of vertices, this becomes omega of n, proportional to n, not so good. Now this is in the arbitrary CRCW PRAM. Exactly the same example shows that algorithm is R is bad in their computer model. So here we're using a more powerful computer model, and the question is, do we actually get some benefit in terms of simplicity out of this? Right, this is the conclusion. So maybe they didn't want to think about the more powerful model, because had they, maybe they would have got a simpler algorithm here. In any case, Auerbach and Shloach further simplified the algorithm. They simplified the analysis to same bounds. John Reif, actually, before this result, now the Shloach and Vishkin algorithm and the Auerbach and Shloach algorithm are both deterministic. There's another possibility here, which is to use randomization. And actually, Reif has a beautiful, very simple, randomized algorithm with the same bounds as these deterministic algorithms. He uses the randomization to restrict the connecting so that you don't build up long paths. Every connecting only builds trees that have two levels, basically, and then you do one round of shortcutting and everything becomes flat again, so it maintains the flatness of the trees. And the analysis here is quite straightforward. And this is nice, elegant, simple. There's one algorithm, and there's a whole bunch of other work here. I'm just mentioning some of the simple results. The only algorithm that we found that, remember, there's this idea that the parent pointers don't create cycles. This algorithm allows cycles, but it uses something like a shortcutting process to contract the cycles so they go away. And it has an interesting bound here, log to the 3/2 times n parallel steps. This is in the concurrent read exclusive right, so this is the weaker model. So these results are not strictly comparable. But it's an intriguing eccentric algorithm. So the culmination of this work, a whole bunch of other ideas, more and more complicated algorithms. Halperin and Zwick, where are you sitting here, have two beautiful algorithms in the exclusive read, exclusive write model, the weak model, using randomization, logarithmic number of steps, but now the work is down to linear. So this is as good as a sequential algorithm. You can turn this into a linear time sequential algorithm. This only needs m plus n divided by log n processors. And one of these not only finds components, but it finds finds spanning trees of the components. This is kind of the culmination of the PRAM work, the weakest possible model, the best possible bound, but very complicated. Pretty much uses all the ideas that everybody came up with. I think that's accurate. Is that a fair assessment? Worry, would you say?
Yeah.
So here's another interesting point. We found one algorithm that creates non-trivial cycles, but all of the algorithms are monotonic in the sense that in the connection step, they're not moving subtrees around. So this idea of moving subtrees around only emerged with the next era, which is the era of the practitioners trying to solve real problems on huge graphs, on parallel machines, usually some kind of distributed computing model. I mentioned some of these already. And the goal is to actually solve these problems in practice. So the algorithm better be implementable by a semi-competent programmer. So what happened here was that the practitioners read at least some of the PRAM papers, notably the Shalowa-Kavishkin paper, or at least read the first part, and then tried to implement that algorithm or some variant of that algorithm or came up with their own algorithms and made claims that are not necessarily true. So let me just... some of these are too complicated, but not all of them. I mean, the Auerbach Shalowa, you can actually implement it, but anyway... not content, they invented definitely simple algorithms, but with either flawed or invalid proofs of the resource bounds. So neglect of the theory here, perhaps to the detriment of the outcome. So what is this model? Let me speak about it in a high level. We have a whole bunch of processors. Each one has a local memory. There's no common global memory. The only way processors can communicate is by sending messages to each other. They do computation in lockstep. They have some information. They can do some amount of local computation, possibly an arbitrarily large amount. Then they all send messages to other processors. Then all the processors read the messages, and then we repeat. We're ignoring message contention both on inbound and on outbound messages. So we're assuming that any process can read all the messages it gets at the same time, and a process can send messages to everybody else at the same time, but they have to know about the other people they're sending messages to. They have to kind of get started. So to restrict this model to our problem, let's assume there's one process per edge and one process per vertex, and all you know at the start is that the edges know their ends. So beginning, every edge can send a message to its two endpoints, and then the vertices get in the game because they know the edges. But you can't send a message to somebody if you don't basically have their address. So in this model, you need at least log d parallel steps to compute the components. D again is the diameter. And you can prove this fairly easily as both a lower bound and an upper bound. If you do a flooding process, you can end up computing the connected components in log D rounds. But I haven't, not only did I ignore read and write contention, I also ignored message size here. So this algorithm is not practical because the messages end up being huge, quadratic size or something like this. Our algorithms, AR and S, can all be implemented very simply in this model. They use minimal message sizes, and the ones that people actually implemented, most of them use more realistic message sizes. So in fact, this is a goal to shoot for, and I'll come back to this, but for the moment, the goal is just to get log n with a simple algorithm. So we can implement these algorithms either in the old PRAM model, but the strong version, or in the distributed model with realistic messages. Now, here are some examples of these sort of flawed practitioner algorithms. In 1994, there was a SPA paper. SPA is a well-known theoretical parallel algorithms conference. Greiner ran some experiments with various algorithms, and he proposed in particular what he called a hybrid algorithm, which is essentially algorithm S with a twist, although he had edge alteration in it as well, but that's not an important part of it. So the algorithm does repeated shortcutting so that all the trees are flat after each round. It only connects roots. It does edge alteration that is pushing the edges toward the roots, but this is irrelevant if the trees are flat. It has no effect, basically. Here's the crux of the biscuit. In order to try to speed things up, he alternated rounds. So in the odd rounds, he would resolve the right conflicts using minimum values, and in the even rounds, he would resolve right conflicts using max values. So min, max, min, max. The idea was that if connecting via a min didn't get you connected, the next round connected by a max would get you connected. He claimed a log squared bound on rounds. One log factor comes from the inner loop repeating the shortcuts. The other log factor came from the fact that he claimed that the number of trees goes down by a factor of 2 every 2 rounds. Turns out not. Turns out this algorithm, you can construct bad examples, linear in the diameter, linear in n in the worst case. This algorithm, if you throw out this and always resolve based on the min value, you get basically algorithm S, which we can prove actually has this bound. So he didn't talk about this possibility. I don't think he looked at analyzing this version. He just added this rule because it seemed heuristically like a good idea, but you go from a good, simple algorithm to a more complicated algorithm with bad cases. And this algorithm seems to be beloved by the GPU community, which is one of those doing parallel algorithm analysis. So it got picked up by a number of implementers. And these claims with false proofs in some cases just kind of carry through, which is unfortunate, shall we say. I guess he made this completely plausible claim and never looked at possible counterexamples. But if you think about constructing counterexamples, it's not too hard to construct one. And it's been sitting there since 1994, and lots of implementations. And what I assert is, if you're going to do this, why not go with the simpler version, which has you can actually prove the bound. So here's one that is not quite so bad. Tsoutsouplikas is a former student of mine. These folks are at Yahoo, which is now Oath. They got bought by Verizon. They designed their own Hadoop-like platform, which I think they call Phronos. They invented their own connected component algorithm. They had good experimental results. For one thing, in their platform, they spent a lot of time working on the message contention problem, which is very important experimentally, but we're ignoring it in the theory here. There's an extended connect step. This is non-monotonic. This starts moving subtrees around. They claimed a log bound on the number of steps. The proof is incorrect. They asked me about this paper. I told them their proof was incorrect, but I got intrigued, and that's when I started working on this problem. That was last year. It works extremely well in practice. Indeed, the hybrid algorithm that I just mentioned that has bad examples seems to work well in practice. There may be reasons for that. In particular, the worst case may never come up. Why that is not clear, but in this case, it seems like going with the simpler algorithm with the provable bound should dominate this algorithm. Here, this seems to be a good algorithm. I don't have any bad examples. For all I know, this bound might be correct, but I don't have a proof. Log squared seems within reach. I haven't tried to do a detailed analysis of this because this is still more complicated than the algorithms I've shown you already. Here's another one. This is a simplified version of the Shiloh-Vishkin algorithm, but they're claiming with a log round bound, which is definitely wrong because the Shiloh and Vishkin counterexample kills this algorithm for the same reason it killed their simplification. If they move this algorithm to the combining model where you break ties with the minimum value, you get something like algorithm R, but they didn't talk about that. Here's an interesting one that was published on Archive, not in a refereed place. Splits every edge into two arcs and does transformations of the arcs independently. He claimed an order log D round bound. There's a counterexample in this paper to this. The algorithm also, there's some question about its space bound. He has a proof of a linear space bound. It starts adding edges because of this edge alteration process. The theory in here is completely nonsense, and he didn't do any experiments with this. So things are kind of a mess in the world of the practitioners. What can we prove about these very simple algorithms? What we can prove is that the algorithm A, which does the connection, the shortcutting, and the edge alteration, and can move subtrees around, we can actually prove a log squared round bound. We optimistically conjecture that the real answer is log n, although I don't know how much money I would place on this. And this algorithm R, which is even simpler, we can definitely prove a log n round bound. So this is best possible in this very simple setting that we're looking at. The analysis turns out to be quite complicated and intriguing. This analysis is a little bit complicated. This is even more complicated. It uses the potential function of Auerbach and Shiloh, a variant thereof, and it has to look at multiple rounds at a time. Again, there's this tension between doing lots of connections, which can build up deep trees, and doing shortcutting, which can flatten them out. So you can do repeated shortcutting, which keeps everything flat, but then you're definitely up at log squared. To get this kind of bound, you have to prove something good is happening simultaneously with trees combining and flattening happening concurrently. And the difficulty is you can have flat trees that sit around arbitrarily long, actually, until they get combined with other things. That problem was the one that caused, I think, Shiloh and Vishkin and Auerbach and Shiloh and all these other people to try to make the algorithm more complicated to eliminate that problem. But here we did it by keeping the algorithm simple and complicating the analysis. So I'm rapidly running out of time here. We have to count the right things, and there are different things to count. And here there's an extra factor of log that we can't seem to get rid of. And I won't go through the details there, but let's get to this question of whether we can even do better. So there's a lower bound of log d, where d is the diameter. So there is some hope that if the graph is not too deep, which realistic huge graphs tend not to be, they might have diameter that's a fractional power of n or possibly polylogarithmic. There's a beautiful result of Andoni et al. In a very powerful distributed model of computation that almost gets to log d. It's log d times a log-log factor. And if the graph is dense enough, the log-log factor goes away. This is randomized. It uses a whole bunch of tools. But it turns out, again, we can implement this algorithm now on, actually, this runs on an arbitrary CRCWP RAM, the weaker combining model. We got a simplification that basically uses hashing in a clever way to implement this on a weaker computing model and simplifies the algorithm at the same time. And I'm wondering how much more is possible here. Now, here's the last thing I want to mention, which is all of these results assume lockstep synchrony, which you don't have in practice. So what can you say if you don't have lockstep synchrony? Can you say anything theoretically? I've been doing some work with Siddhartha Jayanti, who was an undergraduate at Princeton, now a grad student at MIT, on the concurrent disjoint set union problem, which we saw could be used for connected components, at least in the sequential setting. In an asynchronous model, where it's very difficult to get any kind of efficiency bounds. But we can get some bounds, and I hope we can translate some of these ideas to the connected components problem and get a log bound or a polylog bound for the number of steps per process, even in an asynchronous setting, where you don't require everybody to operate in lockstep. So even a very simple problem, there is still plenty of stuff to do. Thank you very much. I'll be happy to try to answer some questions if you have some.